الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I greet you with the universal greetings of peace. This is a greeting that has been used by all of the prophets from Abraham through to Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon them all. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 33rd program in our series dealing with the social system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of polygamy in Islam. And I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
This is our third program in our discussion of polygamy in Islam. I wonder if I could ask you perhaps just to quickly highlight the main points we touched on in our second program and
sure.
This topic.
In the last program, we started off by giving some of the anthropological and social or sociological explanation of the existence of polygamy in a variety of cultures in different points of history. And we discussed the various reasons, such as personal reasons, demographic, social, biological, economic, and so on. But we concluded also that all of those explanations in themselves, or each of these explanations by itself, does not provide a satisfactory explanation or understanding of the whole picture of such a complex institution like polygamy. And that all of those reasons interact with each other, and they interact in turn with the outside total social forces, legal, cultural, traditional, and all of these things which may shape the attitude towards polygamy being acceptable or non-acceptable. This is a complex interaction process. But the bulk of the program addressed itself to the nature of polygamy in Islamic law, and we started off by referring to the mention of polygamy in the Quran, and we indicated that there are two verses in the Quran that basically deal with this. One is chapter 4, verse 3, and the other one in the same chapter in verse 129, and we tried to analyze the circumstances for the revelation of these verses, which might shed some light about the spirit behind that. And we have seen that these verses were connected with the question of guardianship over orphans and the fear of doing injustice to them. We have seen that being connected according to the explanation of Az-Zamakhshari, that this is related to the fear of adultery, that if one fears adultery, it's better actually to have a second wife rather than have illicit relationship. And we have seen also that the verses were revealed after the Battle of Uhud, where many Muslims died, leaving behind their widows and their children in need for some care more than simply a handout to them. In need also of a family or a home atmosphere to look after their needs. And we concluded basically that if you really look carefully at the verses revealed in the Quran, that's chapter 4, verses 3 and 129, you're bound to conclude that it shows that monogamy, that's one husband, one wife, is the norm that the Quran encourages. But in the meantime, it allows polygamy not as a requirement, not as a commendable act, but as a conditional permission, which seemed to be designed to deal with certain situations and accentuating problems. And even then, there's the requirement of ability to look after more than one wife financially, and the requirement also of doing justice between them.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there are people who suggest that the Quran itself prohibits polygamy. Could you explain, perhaps, your view of the basis for that comment, and what would your response be to people who would hold that particular view?
Okay. The basis that some people make this argument, and I'm aware of this kind of interpretation, that they say that in verse 3, in chapter 4 in the Quran, it says that you may marry, that's more than one wife, and it requires justice. And it says if you fear that you will not do justice between your wives, if you have more than one, then marry only one. And then they say that in verse 129, which comes later in the same chapter, It says you will never be just and equitable between women, that's between wives, even if you try to. And they say, all right, it says justice is a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it says you will never be able to be just and equitable if you have more than one wife. They say, all right, the implication that it is prohibited. But this is not really a very well-founded kind of interpretation, because the very same verse that they refer to, it says you could marry more than one wife. So it would not make sense, for example, to tell you, all right, you can have two options, monogamy or polygamy, if need be. But it is forbidden to have polygamy. Why say you have two choices to start with?
Mm-hmm.
See, the point is, it's just like saying you can take this or that, but you cannot really take this. So what kind of option do you have? On the other hand, it has been also shown authentically that from the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, relating to himself and many of his companions, had practiced polygamy. They had more than one wife. How could they deliberately violate the teaching of the Quran, and the Prophet would not object to that? So it shows that the permission was there and there is no absolute prohibition. I think, Brother Hamid, the confusion about this whole issue as to whether the Quran really prohibits polygamy or not arises because of the meaning of the term adl, that justice is used in both verses, chapter 4, verse 3 and 129.
Mm-hmm.
But it is used in different contexts, different meanings. In the first verse, that's verse 3, it talks about humanly possible justice. See? That is, mm-hmm. anything that is detectable behavior, like we explained last time, justice by having equal amount of support, clothing, yes. food, housing, time to be spent with both wives, let's say if you have two. And this is the thing that is absolutely required, that if you fear that you wouldn't be just, you should not marry more than one wife. But the term itself, adl, which sometimes is translated justice, balance, that is mentioned later on in the chapter, that's in verse 129, deals with the justice in a sense of having equal feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And if you might recall from the previous session, we discussed also this question of feelings, that feelings is something that you do not control. And the Prophet himself have indicated that you cannot divide in anything that you cannot control, which is the feelings itself, the inclination. And that's why the very same verse says, you will not be just and equitable between women, even if you try to. And then it says, فَلَا تَمِيلُ كُلَّ الْمَيْلِ. So don't you be overly inclined so as to leave one wife like in suspense, leaving her feeling hurt and better, which means that you try your best in terms of feeling, but if you can't have equal feeling, that's something beyond, that is beyond your control. So one would have to put it honestly, really, that there is no evidence, really solid evidence from the Quran that it is forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no evidence that it is required or encouraged either.
Mm-hmm. Well, now many people raise questions about the maximum number of wives that are permitted, the four.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any significance to this number as opposed to, say, six? Or?
Well, the same thing. Suppose the verse said five. Somebody say, why five?
Yes.
If it said three, somebody say, why three? However, some people try to explain some of the possibilities for that particular number. Some, for example, argued that it would be really too much for a wife to be away from her husband, or not to have her husband, you know, spend the day or night with her for more than 3 days. So you say, all right, if the person is married to four, at least her share will come once every 3 days, which they think or judge as a, you know, maximum time. Some said that if you marry more than four, even in the most extenuating circumstances, it becomes very difficult to be just and equitable. That it is very rare for a person to have enough wealth to be able to support four wives. Well, this might be only partial explanations, and I don't think that these reasons by themselves give a satisfactory answer, at least in my mind. But I think the point here that is forgotten, that this number is not an arbitrary number that any human being placed. It comes in the Quran itself, mm-hmm. which for the Muslim is the word of God. And God's wisdom definitely exceeds ours, and we may not be able fully to comprehend particularly the choice of any specific number or any specific maximum for that. So this is one thing. But on the other hand, we are not prohibited from trying to contemplate or try to find possible explanation to understand it better. But it may be kept in mind, however, that the number four stands somewhere in between extreme restriction, like saying, all right, no more than one wife, just monogamy, strict monogamy, and between going into such a large number of wives, which might look really like just a sensuous type of relationship, and that perhaps four as a maximum would cover a variety of accentuating circumstances, wars, very low sex ratio, but it is very unlikely that the need would arise where you need too many people really to get married to more than four wives, whether because of personal reasons or social type of disasters or problems. But the other thing to remember also is that the number four is mentioned in the verse as a maximum, absolute maximum, which means that if the problem cannot be solved in one particular setting, exceptional case, except by having four, fine. If the problem can be resolved by having three wives, that's even better. Two, better. Monogamy, which is the norm according to Islam, that's even much better. So it just established some kind of cutting line to stop the unrestricted practice of polygamy that existed before Islam, as we indicated in the previous program, in different cultures and even under different religions even. So this is the kind of thing, it's just an absolute maximum really, rather than something that should be regarded as the average or norm. No?
Well, many people suggest, well, if the norm is to have only one wife, why then did Islam allow for polygamy in the first instance?
What are the reasons?
What are the reasons?
Okay. Well, most writers, when this question is discussed, they immediately move into listing possible reasons or possible circumstances which may make of polygamy a better and more moral solution of certain problems. And that's fine. And in fact, this is something we should also address. But my approach to this is that before even getting into any of those reasons, especially in a topic like this, which evokes very severe reaction and very strong emotional kind of feelings, that at least for the Muslim, it should be remembered that the permission, or this conditional permission of polygamy, is not something or a law that has been put or set by a human being, even the Prophet himself. It is direct revelation of God. If that law was made by men, you would say they are biased because they are males. If the law was made by women, you would say they are biased because they are females.
Mm-hmm.
God is neither male or female. And when he established these rules or allow certain things, he definitely must have good reason behind it, and no intention whatsoever of being unjust, astaghfirullah, to males or females. That's impossible to just to believe in God and believe that he is unjust.
Mm-hmm.
This is just out of question altogether. So there must be reason. And as indicated earlier, it doesn't mean that, of course, we have no right to try to explore those reasons. But a believer would not say that if I don't get those reasons, I won't believe in what God is saying. I see, I believe in God, but I try my best to understand some of those. This is a basic, fundamental, methodological question. But the point here is that the nature of Islam itself, as the seal of revelation of all the prophets, that there is no prophet after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. There is no holy book to be revealed after him, according to Muslim belief. That Islam, as the Quran indicated, is the culmination of all the messages and mission of all God's prophets throughout history. And if Islam is intended not as a religion for the Arabs or Middle Eastern or Western or whatever, it's intended for the whole world as a universal faith, then by definition, it would not really be eligible to be described as universal unless it has enough flexibility in its laws so as to be able to solve problems in different times, different places, in different circumstances. In different times, because Islam as a last revelation would not be universal, would not be truly universal, if it only addresses the problems faced by people in the time of the Prophet, at our time, in between, or in the future. It must meet the needs of these different times. It has to be time, it has not to be, or it should not be time-bound. Secondly, it cannot be a universal faith when it is tailor-made for the conditions of the Arabs or Americans or Canadians or whatnot. It must be or must have the flexibility to deal with the situation in different cultures, in different settings. So it has to be a faith which is not place-bound. Thirdly, it cannot be circumstances-bound. You could not really have a universal faith that solves problems under certain circumstances,
yes,
under certain cultural practices or norms, but fails or keeps silent on other practical problems faced under different kind of circumstances. So again, to be universal, it must be a faith which is not circumstances-bound. For this reasons, altogether, we realize that there may be circumstances on the individual level or collective level which may make it very difficult to find a solution, a frank, honest, daylight type of solution without having this conditional permission for polygamy. So there must be reasons behind that, but I think the methodology first and the nature of universality of Islam has to be put as the major consideration of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we should turn our attention now to some of the reasons, beginning perhaps with the social reasons. So could you give us some examples of the social reasons which might...
Okay, there are several that could possibly be related to this. First of all, in some places and at certain times, there is a constant complaint of a lower sex ratio. That is when you have a larger number of females and less number of males to get married to. And this might include people who are girls in marriageable age. It may include widows. It may include divorcees. Now, if in such kind of setting there is insistence that anything other than monogamy is wrong and illegal and all that, what will happen for the needs of those girls or women who want to get married but are not able to because of this shortage of males? Of course, in the context of Islam, their basic needs could not be satisfied in any illicit or immoral way. So what other practical solution? Of course, if they don't want to get married, that's their option. But if they do, why should the law make it very restrictive? That's one thing. A second thing, which is quite normal in human history, we all hate wars. Nobody really wants war. That's the basic human instinct to look for peace. But on the other hand, it is unfortunate that so long as there is good and evil in this world, so long as there is human capricious claims, arrogance of power and all that, wars has been a fact of life in the past, at present, and will probably continue until the day of judgment. In most cases, if not almost universally, the casualties of these wars, even though it may include women and children, is very heavily on the shoulder of men. So it's men, or males, who are normally killed in these wars. And of course, if you look at the, for example, the First or and Second World Wars, they talk about really the very large number of men killed, causing a sort of imbalance, like we were describing before, the question of lower sex ratio. What to do in situations like this? And this, in fact, relate to certain surprising information for many audience or viewers who might for the first time hear this, that after the Second World War there have been demands in Europe itself for some form of similar form, I should say, of polygamy that's permitted in Islam. To give you an example, in Munich in 1948, after the war, there was an international youth gathering, and a discussion went on about how to solve the problem of shortage of men after the death in war. And many suggestions were offered, none of which really seemed to have been very practicable and useful. So some of the attendees who were Muslims proposed this notion of allowing polygamy under these extenuating circumstances. Of course, at the beginning, like any Western reaction, it was looked at with disgust and, you know, surprise that how could that be? But after things were discussed, not on an emotional level, on an objective, reasonable, and rational basis, you would be surprised that the people who were attending, representing a variety of cultures and religions, they agreed to adopt polygamy as a recommendation that would solve this problem. In 1949, the residents of the city of Bonn in Germany, they actually made a request to their government that the constitution should have a provision permitting polygamy when the need arises. Another social, again, the circumstance that might fall within this range, which is very similar to the question of wars, is the fact that in human history, even at present, despite the fact that women has also been involved in lots of work and jobs that has been traditionally men's jobs, but still you find that the jobs that involves a great deal of danger of death, like mining, construction, truck driving, and so on, that you find that by and large it's mostly men's type of job, and the death out of these dangerous jobs, of course, might be relatively higher in the case of men than women, and again that would result in lower sex ratio and again the presence of widows and other people who probably might prefer to have a family type of living. On the other hand, there is another question that perhaps can fit either under social or individual, can relate it to both, that maybe there might be some individuals with a sort of overwhelming and strong sexual drive, and it may be in some cases again that if you insist on strict monogamy, you're really leaving them no alternative but to go from the back door and commit adultery and involve themselves in illicit sex relations, which are regarded, of course, in Islam as a major sin and an offense, not only against God or against themselves, it's against society also, mm-hmm. because you have a number of people or women who are being exploited, you have illegitimate children as a result of this illicit relationship. And may I add one more point, which we might have alluded to that in an earlier program, that in some cultures, the polygamy seems to have been part of the social structure. Some of the African countries, for example, that we discussed last time, and we referred to some of the anthropological studies on these people. And in fact, even among non-Muslim societies, some non-Muslim societies in Africa, it was reported several times that the even missionaries and the official position of some churches did permit people who convert to Christianity to keep their wives, because some of them were polygamous when they were pagans. So all of these things shows that there are circumstances on the social level which make polygamy a much more viable and more, let's say, wholesome approach than going from the back door and solve these social problems.
Well, how about the... You made mention of there being individual circumstances which can possibly justify polygamy. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Okay, let me give you an example which approximates reality that I have heard of in several cases. I mean, it's just like compiling these together in a very simple example. Suppose you have a young man in his 20s. He got married to, you know, a girl about the same age. Family life has been very good. Relationship is good. They love each other. Fine. They got two babies. One is 3 years old. One is 1 year old. 1 year old. And then all of a sudden, the wife contracted a very serious disease which would affect her availability to him for husband-wife type of relationship. It could be all kind of things. Some people might be just in the process of slow death, like cancer, leukemia. It could be a sudden mental disease. It could be a possible coma. And we have heard about people who can stay in coma for literally years. Now, the question here is this. What kind of alternatives are open before that husband? One, you could say, all right, he can control his instinctive needs. And if these things happen to continue for 5 years, 10 years, forever, until he dies, that's fine. He should sacrifice and not satisfy his instinctive needs. Well, Islam does not object to that if he wants to. If a person is able to control this basic sex drive for that many years, or forever, until he dies, well, there is nothing explicitly that says you cannot do that. If he can do that, fine. But the question here, how many people, what percentage of young people in their 20s are able to take that route? So that's not a good solution for all. Secondly, he can keep his wife, because he believed that monogamy is the only mode of marriage, and go from the back door because he cannot resist his needs and have mistresses. Again, from an Islamic perspective, that's not permissible because that's adultery. It's even more of an offense. The third, divorce his wife and get married to another one to satisfy his needs and just get rid of her. That sounds like dumping your beloved person at the time of need. That is cruel, isn't it? Okay, what other alternatives besides these three that might be better than any of them, more practical, more wholesome? To get married to another one, satisfy his needs. Maybe that second wife would be instrumental in looking after his young kids, looking after his home. Maybe even if she's noble enough, might even be helping to serve the first sick wife. A practical solution. It might sound surprising because we are raised, or many of the viewers are raised in a Western atmosphere where it is inconceivable to think of a person being married to two wives. But practically speaking, when you look at a situation like that, what meets those criteria of morality, practicality, and kindness? It might not necessarily be the best solution, but the best solution that perhaps you could think of in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. Or else the question is posed to any viewer. What would be a better way?
Mm-hmm.
Practical, better way, and moral, meeting all these criteria. Where?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm getting the signal that we've exhausted our time for today. We'll continue this discussion next week. We want to invite you back. We want to thank you for watching our program. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu akbar. Allahu akbar.